chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make dab in the middle of it. Rest make dab in the middle. We are rest make dab.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We're going to start off with an interview with Tom Ritz that Alex had. And this is quite an outstanding attorney, and he's been into these COVID deaths and illnesses for quite a while. But he has quite a bit to say about killing floors in possibly some of the hospitals. And he has a case in Alabama where he's trying to zero in on something akin to that. So here we go with Tom Rentz and Alex.
When I was getting these thousands and thousands of calls, and literally one of the hardest periods of my life, to have person after person call me and die and die and die and die, and I couldn't save them all. When this was happening, you know, it got to the point where someone would call me. I pick up the phone. Okay, how long have they been in the hospital? Okay, 8 days. What are their kidney numbers? What is it? What is their respiration? Are they on the vent? How long have they been on that vent? I could ask a series of questions, and I could tell you and predict with 90%+ reliability, despite the fact that I'm not a doctor, how many days they had before they were dead. And that's all over the country, because the same murder protocol, the same factory death project was done everywhere in the country. These people, they followed the law. They followed the incentives. They followed the money. They followed the plan. And the plan was to kill people. We incentivized, and still to this day, the laws have not been changed, by the way. We have laws on the book that incentivize not the recovery from COVID, but the killing with COVID. So I want you to understand what I just said, Alex, in plain terms. You got a PhD, super high-end, quality-educated pharmacist, as credentialed as anybody on the planet, in a hospital, says to the hospital, your policies could result in patients dying. Can I have an exemption from supporting these policies? And instead of the hospital saying, oh, my God, they could? We need to change these policies or at least reevaluate them. Instead, the hospital fires her and retaliates and won't give her a religious exemption. She was asking for a religious exemption from being complicit to murder. In my mind, that's how I view this. And I mean, what can I say about, instead of the hospital saying, oh my gosh, we need to look at this. We need to evaluate. Is this right? Did this pharmacist find something? Did we not know? Instead, they triple down and they fire the pharmacist. They're not using mRNA. They're using modRNA. And this is critical. Now, this abstract of this starts with, quote, reprogramming non-cardiomyocytes into cardiomyocyte, like cells, is a promising strategy for cardiac regeneration in conditions such as ischemic heart disease. We used modified mRNA gene delivery platform to deliver a cocktail termed ... of four cardiac, quote, reprogramming genes. Alex, they aren't using mRNA. They're using modRNA, and they are reprogramming our genes. It says so right here. It goes on later to talk about, and it says, quote, modRNA is currently being used around the globe for vaccination against COVID-19. They know. They are creating genetic changes in humanity, and they are doing so intentionally, and they're not telling you.
All across the Western world, hospitals were paid the equivalent of $53,000 to secretly lock people up, put them on ventilators, and then give them a cocktail of drugs to kill them. while the families were left outside. Many of the hospitals where they did this were cleared out of the regular medical staff. And then many individuals posing as doctors and nurses carried out the killings. Well, I've been interviewing him for over 2 years, and I thought he was credible at the start, but I know he's completely credible now. So many of the top whistleblowers from the DOD, the vice president of EcoHealth Alliance, all of them went through Tom Renz, attorney. He's a lead lawyer in several major cases brought to Ohio, New Mexico, Maine, and nationally against the CDC, DHHS, and Fauci regarding forced vax mandates, big tech censorship, these COVID-19 lockdowns, mass mandates, business closures, false PCR test data, fraudulent death numbers, and more. And he works with a lot of doctors and scientists around the world. Renz, RENZ-law.com. Now, this is really a chink in the enemy's army, in the enemy's armor. This is a lot bigger than the hundreds of thousands of people they killed here and hundreds of thousands more around the Western world. It's about setting the precedent to be able to carry out larger scale operations like this in the future. This is eugenics. This is euthanasia. This is depopulation. You see Canada saying, we're going to make people commit suicide now. We're going to kill mentally ill people who are wards of the state. And the ward says, I'm going to kill you. We're going to kill children who are just depressed. We're going to sterilize your children. It's happening here. This is the weaponization of the medical system against us. And key hospitals, 139, I said 138 from memory, around the country, from this whistleblower information and the audio and the documents, carried this out. More modern hospitals, highly controlled. Remember, they would also do the PR stunts that were documented all over the country and all over the world. But they'd say, oh, look, it's overwhelming. Lines, hazmat, don't come to the hospital. Can't do your regular surgery. You got a heart attack? Don't come here. But they sent most of the staff home and brought in key people to carry out this beta test for what they had done. Now, the great Dr. Jane Ruby, who we need to get back on the show, had Tom Renz on a few days ago. It's gone viral. Breaking whistleblower, pharmacist, tape confirms hospital murders are intentional, using morphine overdoses to hasten deaths in COVID patients. But it gets worse. Remember what happened in the UK. They got a stockpile of a drug that's used to put people under, an anesthesia, and they would kill them with that, knowing that if you give somebody even a small amount of this, they can't breathe. Number of prescriptions for the drug midazolam doubled during height of the pandemic. And right before the pandemic started, the UK government ordered the biggest stockpile ever of it. And it goes on from there. FDA reports shortage of sedation drug used for putting COVID-19 patients on ventilators, which also means you can't breathe. Even though you're on a ventilator, it shuts the lungs down. They gave remdesivir that shuts down the kidneys and other parts of the body. Midazolam was used to end the lives of thousands who were told have died of COVID-19, and the NHS document proves staff were ordered to do it. Now, if they get away with this crime, they can get away with anything. And Tom Renz joins us. We'll also air part of the tape. He'll give us updates on where this is going. But Tom, I know this is hard work, but I just see your tirelessness. I see you everywhere. We salute the work you're doing. And I'm just so proud to know you. Obviously, we need to expose this because, as I predicted a few months ago when they ended the pandemic, I said the UN would later say we ended it because a new one's coming. They now announced that last week. So they're getting ready to hit us again. We've got to take this down. We've got to intellectually, culturally convict them in the court of public opinion so no one goes along with them. And we see Chelsea Clinton saying there's less trust in the big pharma now than there was 3 years ago. Exactly. Obama came out and pines for old days when people believed the media and they could control the common set of facts. Well, the truth is they killed a lot of us, but they really lost in their COVID attack in that they wanted to keep the lockdowns going longer, wanted to set the precedent for the world medical ID. That has failed by and large. The new UN treaty to take sovereignty is in deep trouble. So we're in a fight for our lives. Tom Renz, we salute you. Thanks for being here.
It's mutual. Alex, it's been an honor to get to know you over the last couple of years and to stand with you pushing truth. You know, the thing about this is I was shocked. And, you know this, Alex. When I started fighting this, you know, I'm just some nobody from a little town. And so when I hear things, you know, I would hear Alex Jones, you know, that guy, he's on, you know, he's talking about how they suppress his information. All this stuff. I used to hear that and think, boy, I don't know about that. That seems ridiculous. Now, fast forward 3 years. 3 years of me getting my chops busted every day for telling truth. I mean, you know, I'm putting out paperwork that I got recordings, I've got cited government documents, I got all this stuff, and what they tell me is that it's fake news. Are you kidding me? It's absurd. So I got to tell you, Alex, I'm honored to stand with you and to get just a little bit of understanding of what you've been through for so many years. So I appreciate all that you do as well.
Well, we're not as bad off as the folks they murdered on these ventilators and what they're planning to do next. So there's a lot going on with COVID, and I'm going to get updates on all the other lawsuits and things in a moment. But let's drill into the ventilators. I mean, we know family couldn't visit. They kicked the rest of the staff out. Same policy worldwide, bounties to put people on ventilators. And we know the drugs were killing them. They knew it, said don't give it to somebody on a ventilator. So they stockpiled it ahead of time. I mean, all that proves it was a conspiracy. We could convict any of them with just that evidence. But now you've got the big pharmacist groups, everybody. They know what's on the indications, and they know what they've been told. Lay this out for us.
Yeah, so let me start with this from the law, right? And I want people to understand how this was done. And so that you don't think that this is an accident or a one-off, I want you to understand the way the law worked on this. We legislated hospital murder factories, okay? So this came from our government. Now, I don't think that the buffoons that voted for the laws actually knew what they were doing. I mean, we got Nancy Pelosi. You got to pass the law.
No, exactly. You get global policy pushed by the UN. The governments just sign on to it. It's the people writing the policy. Well, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. No, you're dead on, Alex. Listen, the people that were pushing this, they were behind the scenes. The people that voted on it were just too dumb and lazy to read the bills. So here's what happens. We got, and I'm gonna use the word law generally to include policy, regulation, guidance, all these sorts of things. We've got the law that's shifted, and National Center for Vital Statistics, the CDC, the HHS, all these people, all law, they say, listen, if you're coughing, if you've got any symptoms of COVID, we want you to call it COVID. If you've got, it doesn't matter what it is. If it's COVID, if it could possibly be COVID, we want you to diagnose COVID. And if you diagnose it as COVID, that's fine. And you'll get a bonus. If you don't diagnose...
And I'm sorry to interrupt, but just to back you up, remember, zero flu in all these countries for those years because they were calling flu that and killing them. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, you got an incentive, right? You got extra money to call it COVID. But if you didn't call it COVID, you were going to get a call from the government saying, why are you not listing these people as COVID? And they say, well, what are the symptoms? And the symptoms for COVID and the flu were identical, by the way. They were indistinguishable. I've put the side by side up before. They're indistinguishable. So you've got everything being diagnosed as COVID, and you get a bonus if you diagnose it as COVID because we pass a law that says if you've got COVID, not only can you call it COVID regardless of what it is, but you get extra money for calling it COVID. Then we pass more laws, and the laws, what they do is they make it so that once you have COVID, if you give someone the appropriate treatments, you get a whole bunch more money. Well, the appropriate treatments start out with things like remdesivir, which causes system failure and kidney failure and organ failure and all sorts of problems. Not in every person, but in enough of them. You throw in things like you mentioned milazepam. Well, it suppresses your breathing. Your oxygen levels fall. So anybody that lost a loved one in the hospital, you can be assured of one thing. They were probably getting a sedative of some type, and that sedative was suppressing their breathing, which means their oxygen levels and saturation inherently go down, which means then the hospital tells you that you need to go on a ventilator. Well, they got a big bonus for using their remdesivir and these approved treatments, and then they get another bonus once they get you on the ventilator. Well, the approved treatments push you towards the ventilator. So then you're on a ventilator. Hospital gets another bonus. Then to top the whole thing off, once you die and they call you a COVID death, the hospital gets another bonus. So instead of incentivizing hospitals treating patients and getting them healthy, we incentivize hospitals murdering patients. On top of that, Alex, as if all that wasn't enough, we also passed laws that said if you're treating COVID, you can't get sued unless you can prove that you acted willfully and in the patient's against the patient's interests. What that means to a lawyer is this: I have to prove that that hospital meant to kill you to file a lawsuit on your COVID treatment. Right?
So you as a lawyer that are an expert on this, you see them premeditatedly setting it up to make it harder for them to get in trouble.
Absolutely. Well, you got to understand, not only do you have to prove that. So in any instance, anytime you have to prove
someone acts willfully, that is very difficult in court. Now, when you combine that with the fact that they've incentivized everybody using the exact same treatment protocols, what that means is that not only do you have to prove that they acted in bad faith, but you have to prove that everybody acted in bad faith. Because at the end of the day, what they're going to do when I say, listen, these guys acted in bad faith, they knew they were killing people, they're going to say, no, this is what everybody did. You can't prove that. We just did what everybody
did. Yeah, we're not bad. We're just following the global policy.
Their defense is if everybody jumps off the bridge, I had to, too. And so there ends up, from a legal perspective, they essentially create immunity on a level that is almost impossible to pierce. Almost. Now, when we start looking at and analyzing this from the position of willfulness, well, we're getting to a point now where I think we're just about able to show that. Because as statistics, as facts, as evidence is coming out, you know, it looks more and more like this is willful. These guys knew what they were doing.
Sure. Well, of course it's willful. It's premeditated. But if you can expand on that, under international law, common sense, just because they've been given immunity in some regulation, again, willful conspiracy, that everything's overridden by that.
Absolutely. Well, as an added bonus, in certain instances, RICO will take precedent over government immunity. So these crooks in the federal government that were pushing this, if we get to the right point, we've got the right evidence, we're going to actually be able to go after them as part of a RICO claim, because this was a corrupt enterprise, in my opinion. I don't think there's any question about it. We're getting closer, but, you know, for the people who are impatient about this, and I understand why, because I know how many – I got the phone calls, Alex. I can't tell you. I got every day for months on end – phone call after phone call. People tell me, listen, my loved one, my sister, my brother, my aunt, my mother, they're dying in the hospital. They tell us she's got 3 days to live, but they won't let us try ivermectin. They tell us there's nothing else they can do and that they aren't going to do anything, but they won't let us try hydroxychloroquine.
Oh, no. I would open the phones up and people were just begging with loved ones dying who were totally healthy. And so, I remember we had the whistleblower nurse out of New York where they would just grab homeless people and throw them in. They weren't even sick and they just murder them.
Yeah, no question about it. And, you know, and there's a great image of how empty this was. The only time you actually saw sick patients was when they set it up for a photo op. You know, this was unbelievable what was occurring. And, you know, meanwhile, you see these idiots that were in the medical profession doing this stuff at the time. And the thing is most of the idiots that you're showing right now actually thought they were doing good. See, they didn't bother to do their homework. What they did was they read the CDC guidance.
They just sat there. Most of them got sent home. The others just put people on ventilators and took the money.
Yeah.
So they're dancing while people are dying.
Yep. They read the guidance. They listened to the administrators. Whatever the hospital says, that must be true.
And the media said they were all heroes. We'll be right back.
Yep.
All right.
Yep.
We just joined some stations that just joined us. Continue, Tom Renz. Breaking that down for people, how this conspiracy worked and what this new whistleblower information is you have.
Yeah, so, you know, we've been working on gathering the data because we have to show willfulness. Well, so I get a call from a wonderful lady, and she doesn't really want to be public. I mean, her name's public because she's filed a lawsuit and it's public record. But she's asked me to speak for her publicly because first of all, she wants to make sure she's not saying anything that's going to damage her lawsuit. And second of all, she wants to make sure that she's not looking for fame or fortune. She's a mom of five. She's got a PhD in pharmacy, Stanford educated, one of the most qualified pharmacists I've ever ran across. I mean, the woman is a brilliant pharmacist. And her name is Adrini, and she comes forward and she says, listen, I'm a pharmacist. I had worked in clinical trials with big pharma, this, that, and other. I wanted to get back into patient care, went back into that. And while I was at the hospital working during COVID, you know, I was looking at the drugs they were using, and I felt that their protocols created an opportunity to hasten death. Now, hasten death is it's a term that's used, but don't overthink it. If I shoot you in the head, I'm hastening your death, right? It's a polite way of saying killing someone. It doesn't matter how you hasten death. Hastening death is still killing someone, right? So she says, you know, they wanted me to sign off on these protocols that I thought were going to hasten death or that had the potential to cause death, this, that, and other. I said, well, okay. She said, well, I applied for a religious exemption because I didn't think that was right, and they ended up firing her and retaliating against her. So I want you to understand what I just said, Alex, in plain terms. You got a PhD, super high-end, quality-educated pharmacist, as credentialed as anybody on the planet, in a hospital, says to the hospital, your policies could result in patients dying. Can I have an exemption from supporting these policies? And instead of the hospital saying, oh, my God, they could, we need to change these policies or at least reevaluate them, instead, the hospital fires her and retaliates and won't give her a religious exemption. She was asking for a religious exemption from being complicit to murder, in my mind. That's how I view this. And, I mean, what can I say about instead of the hospital saying, oh, my gosh, we need to look at this. We need to evaluate. Is this right? Did this pharmacist find something? Did we not know? Instead, they triple down and they fire the pharmacist. I mean, think of how absurd that is. So we've got a pharmacist, you know, as an added bonus to all this, because, you know, what I hear a lot of people tell me a lot of things, right? And I always have to, I mean, you know, at this point, Alex, I quintuple verify everything times 10. Well, it turns out that Adrini not only said it, but she just so happened to record and document everything she did. So she had recordings, she has paperwork, she has all sorts of things. Now, amongst those recordings, there was a clip which I just released, and that clip is between her, remember, the doctor of pharmacy, and a nurse who works in the hospital. And if you're going to play it, this would be the time, because it's shocking.
We'll set it up for us. Tell us what we're about to hear.
What you're about to hear is Adrini, the pharmacist, talking to a nurse. And what they're talking about is, prior to this, Adrini had talked about how she'd been transferred, and they transferred her position for speaking out against what they were doing. As part of the process, they transferred her, and they did everything they could to shut her up. And so she starts out, you know, they transfer you, and it's politics. This nurse says, starts talking about her floor. And she says, so what are we, hospice care? And she says, you know, this doctor, he's killing patients. He's telling us to kill the patients. And she goes on to talk specifically. There you go. So we're killing the patient in this floor because what he's asking us to do. The other floors don't want to do it. The other floors don't want to do it. You're right. The other floors do not want to murder patients. Shocking. And then they talk about the use of morphine that, you know, based on this conversation, it looks like the unnecessary and unwarranted use of morphine, which is what we saw. A lot of what happened, you know, remdesivir was absolutely poison in my mind. I think it's absolutely a horrible, horrible drug that should have never been anywhere near a human being. But one of the things that not many people are talking about, and this is your pro tip for any of the other attorneys that want to get into this. Remdesivir is a tough one to fight in the courts. But if you look, you'll find the misuse of other drugs was very frequent. Not every case, but known drugs, morphine, milazepam, all these.
Well, right. Now, there's a big scandal in the UK. They admitted that they basically killed people with it. So let's go ahead and play this clip. Here it is. You got to get up and move around. But these drugs are known to put fluid in the lungs, make you give up, make you die. And so they premeditated. But notice, other floors, the hospital wouldn't do it. The special floors would, Tom.
Yep. And, I mean, that clip is monumental. I mean, this whole floor, how many people died on this floor? And what I'm hoping
And that's a nurse practitioner, basically a doctor, agreeing with the PhD pharmacist, this is murder.
I'm not sure if the speaker is a nurse practitioner.
Well, they're talking about a nurse practitioner. Yes.
They talk about another nurse practitioner. Yeah. I believe the speaker on there is a nurse. But, yeah, they're talking about murder. They're talking about murder. And when the pharmacist said, I think this is a possibility, instead of them listening, they retaliate. They retaliate. I mean, Alex, this is evidence of willfulness, right, which means there is no immunity. There's no immunity for willful actions, and it looks like that's what's happening here. And what I would suggest is, and what I'm calling for, is I'm calling for the AG of Alabama, along with the local law enforcement, to start an investigation. There needs to be a criminal investigation. Was there murder committed in this hospital? And understand, hastening death, it doesn't matter when that happens. If you hasten death,
it's murder.
How do you distinguish between that and murder? To me, there's no difference. So we've got the lawsuit with my client who's been trying to bring this forward, who tried to bring this to the hospital's attention.
Stay there, Tom Rands, because here's the key. Not just for the victims, for justice, but they're going to do it again. We've got to expose them before they do it again. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
I'm going to post up that full interview as an embedded video. But next coming up is a very important interview that Sean Hannity had with O'Boyle, one of the whistleblowers, one of the FBI whistleblowers. And he's saying they put out some kind of a manual where they had the Gadsden flag and things like in Betsy Ross flag as symbols of white supremacy or something. This is getting really mad. But listen to this interview with Hannity, and I'll put a link to the full interview up on my site. So here we go with Hannity and O'Boyle.
Pretty amazing testimony. Anyway, joining us now is whistleblower Garrett O'Boyle. Sir, first of all, I'm so sorry what has happened to your family and what you've had to go through. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me on, Sean. I really appreciate it.
What is the status financially of your family now? How are things at this point?
You know, we have seen an influx there's another whistleblower. His name's Kyle Serafin. He set up a Give, Send, Go. And there has been an overwhelming amount of support just since yesterday. And so it does not go unnoticed. It is overwhelming to see the support that people are starting to provide now that they're learning more about what the FBI does to people who simply want to shine a light on the darkness that they love to hide.
Let's talk about what you saw that made you become a whistleblower.
Okay, so there's a number of things. I've been advised that I can only talk about the things that are currently public. So some of the stuff from my testimony yesterday and some of the stuff that came out in the Judiciary Committee's report heading into the hearing. One example we talked about in the hearing yesterday was that militia or domestic violent extremism symbols guide. That's one instance where simple symbols of Americana for decades and years that Americans have clung to as symbols of freedom and hope are now being used by the FBI as indicators of extremism and terrorism. And I think that's one of the primary examples that.
What kind of symbols? Can you be more specific?
Absolutely. So we've got the Betsy Ross flag. We've got 2A, just for the Second Amendment. The one of them that's on there that is special to me is the Gadsden flag with the snake and says, don't tread on me on it. I myself had that flag hanging in our garage in Kansas before we sold our house while I was still an agent there. And then the FBI releases or that symbols guide comes out, and then I end up confirming that symbols guide and sending it to Congress. And it's astonishing and shocking stuff to single out a vast swath of Americans who love this country and who perhaps have those flags or those symbols. You know, many people even have them tattooed. They're so proud of this country. And for the FBI to take those and say these are symbols of extremism in this country now is just shocking. And I know the FBI, because Director Wray testified to it when it was brought up to him in August. I know they say, oh, well, we caveat those those products, you know, with how we're not supposed to investigate people simply for First Amendment protected speech. Well, that entire sheet is First Amendment protected speech, and there's no indication of anything other than, you know, some analyst somewhere probably saying, hey, you know what, I don't like these symbols. I'm going to use them and make them labels for domestic violent extremism in this country, when even many FBI agents are fond of those type of symbols for this country.
How many years ago did you join the FBI?
I first was hired in 2018.
Okay, so you've had a number of years there. Did you see a dramatic change politically in the FBI in those years you've been there?
You know, when I think back over the time, I think the first year especially, I was probably just trying to figure out how to do my job. And then it certainly didn't seem like it was a slow thing. It seemed rather abrupt, where it was suddenly like, what is going on in this agency? And, you know, I mentioned in my testimony how not many people have reached out to me from inside the Bureau. There has been a small contingent who have and who see a lot of the similar things that I see. And one of those people reached out to me again last night and told me how a number of senior agents on his squad cannot wait to retire. They simply are sprinting toward the finish line so they can escape the rot that organization has become.
It's funny, because I have a friend of mine recently retired. I'm not going to say where or how long I've known him. I don't want to give any indication. He was counting down the days till he retired and could not wait to get out of there. And one of the things he said to me, this is not the agency I signed up for. This is not the same agency it was, you know, even 6 years ago or 10 years ago. And he talked very specifically about what has happened. And, you know, we now know the involvement, for example, of the FBI and James Comey and the dirty dossier, and they couldn't verify it, and they still signed a FISA warrant. You're an FBI agent. If you found out Sean Hannity went before a judge and lied to a judge and said something was verified and it was actually debunked and not even verifiable, would you be looking at me as somebody that committed a crime of lying under oath?
Absolutely. And that is one of the most stark examples and how shocking the agency has become. And so many people still act as if there was somehow some type of proof that happened, when in actuality that dossier was garbage from the start. And we touched on it in my testimony yesterday. Goldman went down this line of questioning and talked about how the Durham investigation, he read a paragraph from it and tried to get me to admit that, well, oftentimes then those are open as into investigations, full investigations. And I said, well, oftentimes they're just closed down too. But the FBI didn't even do that initial part correctly by opening a preliminary investigation first, because they had dubious information, and then they didn't verify it. And then they initially ran that investigation on a presidential candidate and then a sitting president for years. This whole country suffered for years on that fraud.
Nearly 4 years. And I know, because I covered it every day, and I'm not patting myself on the back, Garrett, but we got that story right. Everybody else in the media got it wrong. Let's fast forward to the next presidential election, 2020. Your FBI had Hunter Biden's laptop in December 2019. John Solomon says it was completely authenticated and verified in the spring of 2020. I would think that the FBI has the ability to authenticate a laptop, whether it's Hunter Biden's laptop or anybody's laptop, within probably 72 hours. Am I wrong?
I would imagine that you're right. There are some absolute wizards when it comes to cyber information and crimes and technology, and even the operational technology division at Quantico. I mean, it's all top of the line, state of the art stuff. I'm certain they have that capability to rapidly verify that it's authentic.
That's quite an eye opener, isn't it? Anyway, the concluding tomorrow will be the Bilderberg meeting that's being held presently in Lisbon, Portugal. We have a special interview about 35-40 minutes long with Tony Gosling that we're going to play on our second hour. But then, during this first hour, we're going to put a clip in here from The Hill. Rising is the name of the program. And it really gives a good overall description of what the Bilderberg is about. And then if you want to hear on the ground reporting live from with Tony Gosling, we'll go to hour two then. But here we go with The Hill and this clip about what the Bilderberger is about, the Bilderberger meeting, and the Bilderberger group is all about. Here we go next.
A secretive meeting among business, political, and technology elites, also known as the Bilderberg event, is teeing off in Lisbon, Portugal, this week. The CEO of OpenAI, Sam Altman, is meeting with companies including Microsoft and DeepMind leadership, as well as former Google leadership. At the mysterious gathering, an artificial intelligence tops of the agenda, CNBC reports.
Editor of The Gray Zone, Max Blumenthal, tweeted, "The transatlantic neoliberal cabal known as the Bilderberg Group is meeting now at a secret location in Lisbon. Participants include NATO's Stoltenberg, Ukraine's Kaliba, Henry Kissinger, Peter Thiel, Palantir's Karp, Pfizer CEO Albert Bourla, neocon Nord Stream bombing power couple Anne Applebaum and Radoslav Sikorsky, Canada's Chrystia Freeland, the Dutch and Danish PMs, and members of the media who pledged not to cover the event. The only black participant is Democrat pet project Stacey Abrams, who was on the steering committee. Abrams is the CEO of SageWorks, a legal consulting firm that has represented clients such as the Atlanta Dream of the women's NBA. On the agenda is China and India, two major countries that have frustrated the transatlantic project for world control. Not involved in the Bilderberg meeting are any Chinese or Indian participants of any note. Other notable names include National Security Council's Thomas Wright, former Google CEO and chair Eric Schmidt, president of the Goldman Sachs Group John Waldron, and here's the full list of attendees as well, just for your knowledge. Wow, holy great reset, Jessica. I mean, just reading that list of names gave me chills up my arms.
Yeah, yeah. I think about, like, deep state, right? Everyone's like, ah, there's all these secret meetings among the elites, and sure, yes, I worry a lot about what the National Security Agency and CIA and FBI are up to. However, the surface-level state, which is just a bunch of elites and rich people meeting and making decisions of great consequence because of the sheer power they have and resources they control and labor they direct as the CEO of companies. I mean, everything from Sikorsky to Google, OpenAI, these are people with a lot of power who make decisions of great consequence on a daily basis. It was supposed to be members of Congress and elected officials making decisions on behalf of the people in this country. It's just not how it works anymore. And they have these events and try and make it seem like they're not colluding and making decisions of great consequence. Like, this should be the job of the government in a democratic society. We should have to elect you to make decisions of such consequence. But instead, it's meetings like this that are overlooked.
Exactly. And the whole point of having elected officials represent you and make decisions is that you can boot them out of office if you don't like what they're doing. In this case, these people are completely entrenched in these globalized systems. And I wanted to hone in for a second on Anne Applebaum, the part of the neocon bombing power couple, because her husband was the one who was a member of the EU-US delegation who sent that text after the Nord Stream pipeline was bombed, thanking the US for getting it done. And Anne Applebaum was asked about that, and she basically tried to play it off as a joke. And I think that's kind of indicative of this wider mindset that you hear from these global elites, which is kind of mockery and dismissal of people's concerns about how much power they have. They seem to think that it's funny that people look at them and say, actually, a global cabal of elites deciding everything for the entire world, let alone our country, is super problematic. They just brush it off like it's no big deal.
Yeah. Oh, ha, ha, ha. You think we have a secret club, a secret cabal. That's really cute. And it's like, so what else would you call this? What are you doing instead? What are you guys talking about? Release the transcripts of the conversations then if you have nothing to hide and you're just talking and chatting and gossiping about the goings-on in the world. No, of course you're making decisions of great consequence. And every administration that we've seen ignore the problems of antitrust regulations has put us in this position because corporate power is the main problem here, right? It's always been the case that leaders of multinational corporations, people who have stock and shares in those multinational corporations, have colluded and used their power to amass more money, more control over the economy, control more resources and control more labor, and really accumulate such an amount of wealth that they control our politics now. So if Pfizer wants to give some money and donate and lobby members of Congress, they can very easily do it. And it's just been this entrenched plan for so long. And it's so in our face because they're not afraid of us being able to do anything about it, because when a member of Congress is paid, you know, their annual salary of $400,000, $200,000 a year, and someone comes in and says, you know, we're going to donate to all of the members of the party to make policy in this direction or another, now they work for whoever is donating to them, not working for us. Especially this is a problem when you have people like Nancy Pelosi also being shareholders in these very big companies. It's very obvious who they work for, and it's not us. It's these big corporations.
Yeah, it's incredibly frustrating to see that they repeatedly make decisions that benefit big corporations at the expense of the little guy, whether it's going all in on a green energy agenda without any thought to dependability, cost, the fact that the green energy system is propped up by government subsidies, the fact that a lot of countries who have tried to make that shift, such as Germany, which we've talked about before, ends up reliant on countries like Russia and Saudi Arabia for oil in order to keep their lights on. I mean, it's very, very disturbing. Another big global push that they've been doing in these meetings is apparently trying to get people to not eat meat. They're trying to push the idea of eating bugs. I mean, it's all super wacky, like supervillain type stuff. And again, they just think that it's funny.
Yeah, let them eat bugs, Amber. Come on.
I will not live in the pod. I will not eat the bugs.
Yeah, the Sam Altman being a leader in this is really interesting to me, especially when we think about the influence of AI now and the growth of AI and how much this is becoming a central part of the conversation. Because that's a lot of power to control algorithms that can be more effective than humans in some cases, that can displace a lot of our labor. Once you have these people with control of so much data and so much computing power that they can continue to put this computing power to use and make more money off of it, that's such disproportionate control compared to the people who have no access to algorithms and artificial intelligence. And so the fact that they're all meeting with that on the agenda, knowing how much data these companies have their hands on and control over, the fact that they can all collude with Google, which Alphabet has disproportionate control over AI and the data on all of the people living in the country, like, that's really concerning, that he was a main organizer of this and they're all coming together and talking about AI. We should be very concerned about that.
Yeah, they also use these algorithms to suppress speech. A lot of these global cabals have disinformation committees wherein they fund individuals in the media in order to silence debate on issues that they find uncomfortable. A great example of this was when there were disinformation groups working directly with Twitter and Facebook to censor questions about the vaccines, to censor questions about COVID policy. I mean, this is really running the gamut in terms of them trying to suppress anything that would potentially harm their pocketbooks and harm their profits, and also to hurt or undermine their larger goal of creating this global economy.
Yeah, I think, you know, I talk a lot about lobbying, right? The power that these companies have because they have so much money, they can influence our politics in that way. It's a more concern, more of a concern, and maybe an overlooked one. A lot of people say, oh, if we get money out of politics, things will be much better. We won't see all of this corporate power dominating decisions being made in our country. I disagree, because if these folks still have such a concentration of power and wealth, they can control media narratives very easily. It's been done before with Cambridge Analytica. There's really sophisticated usage of data and algorithms to reach people who are susceptible to misinformation, to run media campaigns, and really pay as an advertiser to a mainstream news network and say, hey, maybe you don't run a story on this, maybe you do run a story on this. Their control over media is really control over people's thoughts and the narrative there. So it's much deeper than just, like, we're going to give some members of Congress some money, make some donations, and try to influence politics in that way. But by controlling the public and public thought, they maintain their power as well.
Yeah, it's a really institutionalized effort. We'll be back with more Rising right after this.
We're going to be ending this hour with Marjorie Taylor Greene and her bill of impeachment against President Joe Biden. So here we go with Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene introduced articles of impeachment against President Joe Biden today. Here she is speaking on the Hill earlier.
Biden. Joe Biden has deliberately compromised our national security by refusing to enforce immigration laws and secure our border, allowed approximately 6 million illegals from over 170 countries to invade our country, deprive Border Patrol of the necessary resources and policies sufficient to protect our country. And his administration has willfully refused to maintain operational control as required by the law. He has allowed fentanyl, the number one killer of Americans between the age of 18 and 45, to overwhelmingly flood into our country and kill around 300 Americans every single day. These aren't just Americans. These are people's family members. These are their sons, their daughters, their brothers, their sisters, their mothers, their fathers, their cousins, aunts, and uncles. These are American families.
The fentanyl crisis is obviously a huge deal. So many very tragic deaths because of the high level of just like instant death when you take a substance that has fentanyl in it. The high degree of replacement of heroin is substantially just fentanyl. Unfortunately, I don't hear a lot of good policies for addressing this. The policies I tend to hear are, let's do the drug war harder. Let's go to war with the cartels. And how is that different? That doesn't actually squeeze their bottom line. That makes what they're doing more lucrative. The more prohibited it is. That's the phenomenon we've seen with, you know, prohibition of every substance going back to alcohol in the, you know, 1920s. And then on the broader question of impeaching Joe Biden, you know, over immigration policies, I mean, she's right that the border is a mess. We've seen the images of all these people coming here under unsafe conditions that unsafe for them because of the trafficking component and the journey and all that.
Yeah.
Joe Biden has certainly not done a good job of handling that issue, nor have like any of his successors. So I don't really think it's a impeachment offense. It's a policy that is not going well, in part because Congress has not taken done its job to fix the immigration problem by creating some way for people, a much easier pathway for people to immigrate here legally and then coupling it with actual border enforcement so we don't have this problem.
Yeah, look, for one, it's interesting timing given that a lot of this debate was focused around Title 42. Title 42 lapses. Remember, it's a COVID policy. Right. Everybody wants COVID to be over.
Keep the disease out of the country.
Keep the disease out. If COVID is over, Biden agrees, Republicans agree, everyone agrees COVID is over. It doesn't make any sense, like, logistically, but there was all this fear-mongering around it. Republicans were saying that once Title 42 goes away, we're going to have a flood of people over the border. In fact, we saw a decline in the week following Title 42 no longer being in effect. So the timing of this is a little odd. Of course, there's an issue with the border. It's confusing, though, just outside of criticizing what Democrats are doing, which I think there's opportunity for criticism there legitimately. So Republicans don't really tend to propose much in the alternative as outside of, you know, building a wall, which has no relationship to actually stopping border crossings. Or doing things like opposing the distribution of needle exchanges.
Trump didn't even build. It was the signature thing that he promised.
Right, and he
built,
didn't build
like
it.
A little part of it or
although
something.
He said that he did build it at the town hall.
They built like a little, they
a bit
put up
of
a
it.
Panel or something.
Sure.
Yeah.
But Republicans are also opposing things like needle exchange programs and putting Narcan and making Narcan and Naloxone. Naloxone is the fentanyl life-saving.
Republicans are opposing that?
They constantly are pushing back against the bastard distribution of those public health programs that are able to disseminate those kinds of life-saving treatments and legalizing other kinds of drugs that aren't harmful, like marijuana.
There's an argument that, like,
Biden also opposes that, by the way.
Should carry Narcan on them at this point if you live in the cities.
maybe that is true. So it is frustrating. Also, of course, legislatively, this isn't going anywhere, so it does feel somewhat performative, but, you know, if she wants to make her strong feelings about Biden's border management known. I think that's fair. One other part of this is that there have been pushes by some conservatives to defund DHS. Part of why Biden has kind of limited focus on certain kinds of immigrants in the past is because of a funding issue. There's a kind of a triage situation given the crisis at the border, given the large number of people who are trying to cross the border, and so they decided to focus on different certain kind of migrants. Well, if you want them not to have to triage, then you're going to have to potentially fund both the asylum legal processes at the border and DHS agents more broadly, and some conservatives are trying to do the opposite of that, so it's unclear what the thinking is.
Well, and the thinking here is on this whole thing is very backward, because the cartels are powerful and they're money-making organizations. They traffic in illegal goods, drugs, and the humans being able to cross the border, that's a legal issue. Illegal immigrants are a commodity.
Yeah.
It's sad to describe people that way, but it's true, and they make money off that. So again, making these things even more criminalized is not targeting the cartels. It's making them wealthier.
Right.
So we have to think through that.
Right.
Like you're playing right into their hands, because people are still going to try to get into this country. We can't have that not be the case. It's a great country. People want to come live here, work here, etc. And we've created a system, or we've deliberately, through our neglect, through our policy neglect, have a system where people are coming to this country in a way that is very dangerous for them and that empowers financially these cartels that everyone is so mad about, realistically, correctly mad about, for their role in spreading fentanyl.
But then
you need to create a safe, legal pathway. People can come work here, pay taxes. We have a labor shortage in many sectors. We can't build houses because there aren't enough work crews to do it. We could solve a lot of problems and actually undercut the cartels with a sane immigration policy. Please take that up, Congress.
Yeah.
I'm begging you, please.
And most people agree with you, but that seems not to be the congressional priority right now.
Mm.
On another note, Green also spoke out. This was an interesting story. After Representative Jamal Bowman called her a white supremacist,
calling a person of color the N-word, which should never happen, calling me a white supremacist is equal to that, and that is wrong. Jamal Bowman was down there cursing at me, telling me to get the F out of there, and he was leading the mob right outside the vehicle I was sitting in. We have this all on video. And then on the Capitol steps yesterday, he was the one that approached me. Even CNN reported that. Yelling, shouting, raising his voice. He has aggressive his physical mannerisms are aggressive, and he just recently shoved Thomas Massie just outside the House chamber. I think there's a lot of concern about Jamal Bowman. So, and I am concerned about it. I feel threatened by him.
Well, he shouldn't have called her a white supremacist if that's what occurred. I don't think that's a fair description for Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Well, he has a right to call her a white supremacist, and people can object to it and think less of him or not
vote
for him.
Including her. She's objecting to it.
Yeah. But there's no, you know, he can describe her politics and her views the way that he thinks is appropriate, and she can advocate, she can say that that is akin to using the N-word. I think that if she thinks those kinds of words are similar in weight and meaning, that she should go ahead and use it.
What do you mean by that?
She should go ahead and say the N-word.
Well, but I don't think they're equivalent to, the raw ugliness of the N-word makes it very unsayable. But she wasn't saying it should be easier to say the N-word, right? She wasn't saying that saying it is a good thing. She's saying, I felt maligned.
If describing someone as a white supremacist is as serious, as ugly, and as unsayable as calling someone the N-word,
she was saying
we shouldn't do that. Right. Well, then we shouldn't be saying white supremacist. She's saying white supremacist out loud. I think obviously the ability for many people to describe things as white supremacist, including the Allen, Texas shooter, who was a self-identified white supremacist who was covered with Nazi tattoos. We live in a world where people like Elon Musk and many conservatives have, for some reason, been working overtime to make the case that this man, who they're not connected to and have no need to defend ostensibly, is not in fact a white supremacist. I do think that there is a way that the word white supremacist has been overused in today's discourse.
Yes, I've been called a white supremacist.
And I've been called a black white supremacist by Tiffany Cross, an MSNBC reporter. So I understand that the word has been overused. And perhaps Jamal Bowman overused it. I wish that we saw the context. If she has video, I hope that she releases it or becomes broadly available, because I think that we should see that. At the same time, I think that it is obviously an apples to pears comparison. White supremacy is describing a phenomenon of people who believe that because of their race, they are better than other people. Oftentimes there is a genocidal underpinning to that. They want to exterminate other people. They want this to be a white country. They see this as it's white nationalism. It is related to the great replacement theory and the feeling that America is becoming a worse country because it is becoming a less white country. We have had people, including very prominent news reporters, talk about how immigrants are dirtier and poorer and ruining this country. And that is something that is, in fact, a white supremacist ideology.
We should call white supremacists white supremacists. We shouldn't call anyone the N-word. We should call white supremacists white supremacists.
Yeah, I mean, that's why the comparison.
Fuentes is a white supremacist.
But that's why the comparison is inapt, because one thing is describing an ideology, and one thing is just a derogatory term for black people. So I just don't understand why one, in the context of pushing back against the accusation of white supremacy, would bring up the N-word at all. I would simply say, I'm not a white supremacist. I believe in the equality of the races. I think America is great because it's a pluralistic country. Those are all things that a person can say to push back against accusations of white supremacy.
I agree with you. Calling someone who is not a white supremacist is derogatory toward them, and you shouldn't do it. But it's his right to do it. I agree with that.
Yeah.
And they're not equivalent. I also agree. So.
Yeah, it's just a really weird place that we're in. I wish that Marjorie Taylor Greene, you know, and she is trying to impeach the head of the FBI as well. I think that is a much more constructive move. I wish that there were. Was legislation that was drawn up to defund the FBI, generally speaking, as she advocated for last year. I think that there are opportunities for defunding the police broadly across the ideological spectrum if people were willing to work together. We have Americans in the middle of an economic crisis that's very significant. We're on the brink of the debt ceiling crisis, where Republicans are trying to argue that we should make it harder for people to get food benefits while not touching any of our revenue issues with the rich being.
And if you're a member of Congress, let's not, you know, sit on our thumbs and just be really angry about the influence of the cartels and what they're doing to this country without proposing a policy to fix immigration.
And also it's about Jamal Bowman as well. I don't think that he's threatening or at risk of actually attacking
anybody. I didn't see him shove Massey in that exchange. It was a very heated exchange.
Yeah. But I do think that he is performative and bombastic, and it's not helpful to his credibility. It doesn't advance the policies that he reports to support. He has a lot of energy around things like calling people white supremacists and not a lot of energy around advocating for policies like Medicare for All, which he claimed to support as he was getting progressive support to get into office. There are real crises afoot, including real white supremacist crises afoot, that you can make more credible arguments about and try to do something about from a legislative perspective. And I think that he has been very purposefully engaging in a kind of political pageantry that can be productive in some instances, but not if it's about kind of getting YouTube clips circulating about yourself, and that's not tied to any legislative agenda.
All right, we'll have more Rising right after this.